meeting. Indeed, we've circulated the agenda for this meeting, and if you don't have, could you please indicate by show of hands so that you can be given a copy of the meeting secretary. Shall we close our eyes and invite our Creator to guide us? Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming to this meeting, because the success of this meeting depends solely on your attendance, but also on the preparation for the meeting. Today we are meeting to receive a briefing from the Parliamentary Budget Office on their analysis of Eskom finances. Well, we know that government's program to reform state-owned companies targets both short-term stabilization measures and long-term efforts to strengthen the governance framework of these entities. So we wish to see a sustainable and clean Eskom, and we're hoping that this briefing will then fill us in with information and assist us in this regard. It is only when we are informed and knowledgeable about these issues that we will be able to make quality input. The latest blame is on, much as we want to blame the state-owned entities and departments for not doing their work, the other side of the coin is, what have we done to make them to do their work and manage their budget effectively and efficiently? So the latest, I promise you, the latest is now, this thing is turning around. What have you done? You are equally to blame. So we want to move away from that. And as this committee, we must make the difference. And I pray and ask God to help us to share the same vision, and also to help us with wisdom, so that indeed we make an impact. Wherever we come in to intervene, we make an impact. So thank you once more for coming, and you are welcome. Please feel free, this is our meeting. Let's get down to the business of this meeting. So we'll move to apologies. Are there any apologies? Okay, Honorable Dr. Fee.
Sorry, Chair, before we move to apologies, if you'll allow me, can we include an item on the agenda, item number 7, the committee program? I would like to just raise an issue there.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
The committee program. Okay, let's say POA and then closure. It will be 7 and then 8 will be closure. Agreed?
Yes.
Agreed. Okay. Thank you. Now let's move on to item number 2, which is apologies.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, members of the committee and guests. We have one apology from Honourable Sheikh Emma. Given indicate.
All right. I know that there's one apology from Honourable Sheikh Imam, and I know that in the previous meeting we did say it will help us if the member mentions the reason, so that we can then take a correct decision on to accept or not to accept. So that information is for that. Do we accept the apology? For now, do we accept the apology?
Yes.
Accepted. All right. Thank you, Viv. Yes, ma'am.
An apology from Dorenta, who's attending L.
Okay. Honorable member Snukwanyana is attending the other committee where she is deployed. All right. Thank you very much. I want to believe that one also is accepted. So shall we then move on to item number 3, which is presentation by Parliamentary Budget Office It's a presentation on its research findings on Eskom finances.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Again, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, thank you for the opportunity that you provide for us to do this presentation. Chair, I don't want to say more than your introduction because I think you've captured everything that we wanted to say, specifically the focus on the oversight role that the committee plays and the contribution to governance is critical. I think, as you mentioned as well, the role of state-owned enterprises in economic transformation is a critical issue. So we need to focus on, you know, the efficiency and effectiveness of how these institutions operate and how they contribute as well to the South African economic transformation scenario. So, Chair, before you, I think we have produced both the full report and a presentation, so you can follow it in whatever way. And I'm going to ask, Chair, my esteemed colleagues to do the presentation. I'm going to ask Siraj Mohammed and Gloria Nguni and Rashad Amara who will do the presentation on behalf of the speaker. With your permission, Honourable Members, we will proceed with the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present this to you, and we hope that it provides you with information to make your decisions a bit easier. It's a very complex area, and I think the problems are quite big. To start with, our outline is we're going to be looking at the purpose of the presentation, background, looking at Eskom's revenues, Eskom's expenditure, and then focusing on Eskom's liabilities within the overall context of its balance sheet. Then we're looking at changes facing the electricity supply industry, and then get our conclusion. We've got quite a few slides, so I think if we are going too fast, just slow us down and let us know if we need to explain something further, or if we're going too fast for you, that will be think. Just in terms of the purpose, the report is compiled in response to a request from the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Appropriations. The committee asked the PBO to investigate the financial position of Eskom. broadly, the background is that Eskom is a state-owned enterprise whose importance to the South African economy and society and economy is unquestionable. Now, one of my colleagues who saw this presentation said I was using less academic language and more colloquial language by saying it's unquestionable. And I actually deliberately did that as a provocation because I don't know how many of us actually, other than when there's load shedding, think about what happens in the life for us and how it affects not only us as individuals, but society, hospitals, people's lives, etc. It has a huge impact on society. Later, I'll be making an analogy between that was used with the big banks that are too big to fail, and I sort of use that kind of analogy to talk about Eskom as well. And again, it may not be the most academic use of the language, but I think in terms of thinking about, can we imagine what could happen if Eskom or large part of Eskom were to close down, what the impact would be. And so and that was the discussion in the financial crisis and why the banks were bailed out, is that the closure of one bank will ripple through not only the national economy, but in other economies as well, will cause huge problems, and it's better to actually invest time, resources, and money to looking at how you actually help the bank rather than close it down and cause the pain in the economy. So I'm using those terms in that manner. I just wanted to clarify that right at the beginning. So this, again, moving away from the more academic language, saying there's no doubt that the financial challenges faced by Eskom require ongoing close oversight, which is something the Honourable Chair did mention.
If I may interject, could you please elaborate again on the importance of the banks? Because the banks these days, no, are being questioned and questioned. You know?
Well, I was using a term that was applied to many of the banks at the time of the financial crisis, where they were described as too big to fail. Because if you allowed one bank to fail, it would affect the rest of the economy so badly. And later on in the presentation, I used that analogy to talk about Eskom in South Africa, saying that in many senses, we can think about Eskom in similar terms, that for the South African economy, Eskom is too big to fail. If that's clear. So it's not the most academic, analytical term in a sense, but it's a sense that helps us to almost tangibly feel the importance of Eskom for the economy. So I just wanted to explain that up front, because I know people will, especially my colleagues who read our reports and give us feedback, will say, we don't think you're actually being precise enough or defining terms enough, but I think in this case some of the more colloquial terms may be good for the discussion in terms of being controversial in the discussion. The financial challenges faced by Eskom stem from the condition and operation of the physical plant, the transmission system, and the distribution system, as well as conditions that affect the cost structure and revenue collection of the utility, including regulatory issues. We also explore some of the broader political economy issues affecting outcomes for Eskom. And we may spend a bit more time than some people think necessary on talking about the political economy issues, but I think for me it was really important because studying Eskom's past and especially looking at the big bill program that started from the early 70s, actually from 1969, where Eskom added a huge amount to the capacity, there were important political economy issues in terms of the relationship between the government, state-owned enterprises like Eskom, Transnet, Sasol to some extent from the 70s onwards, and also the private sector. Now, in a lot of the discussion that comes from mainstream economists, there's a separation of the state and the market. And I think what's really important to understand in the development of Eskom, the coal mining industry, the rail infrastructure, the development of the port and the terminal at Richards Bay, that all of this was due to a certain joint interest, a very close cooperation and relationships between government, the state, and private business, and separating the role of the state and the role of the market within this kind of situation doesn't provide us with the best analysis. So we are going to talk about that in the context of how has this, the political economy changed in terms of the relationship between the different actors, especially private sector actors in coal mining, and other parts of the private sector and government and the state. Overall, Eskom has had to make substantial new investments while facing large increases in its primary energy and other costs. There are risks and uncertainties in the global economy and in South Africa that could negatively affect Eskom. And then there are also large changes in the global power sector that may affect the future structure of power utilities and decisions. And there are important decisions to be made about Eskom's future within the context of these possible changes. So I'm going to ask my colleague, Bashar, to actually come and take the seat so he can change the slides himself as well, and to do the presentation on revenue.
Thank you. Chair, if you would just bear with my limited ability to project my voice, I've been down with the flu for a few days, so if I am speaking a bit too softly, just let me know.
I see Dr. Fink is looking at you because you're not capable of speaking soft. So please go ahead. I think we.
Does it say that you're a medical doctor? No. No, okay. No.
That was on a lighter note. You may proceed.
So revenue obviously is a very important component of overall Islam's profitability and financial position. I'm going to be presenting a high-level overview of some of the revenue trends since 1994. Obviously, revenue has two main components. One is price and one is quantity. So if your price goes up, you obviously can make more money and you're more profitable. And similarly, volume, in this case, the sales of electricity go up, then Islam's financial position obviously is affected as well. The slide over here, let's start our discussion looking at Islam's profitability since 1994 compared to the rest of the economy. So what we have over here is on the vertical axis, that's on the left-hand side, is the level of profitability. Anything below zero is obviously net profit, that's essentially a loss. Anything above zero is obviously a profit. Now if we compare the green line to the orange line, the green line gives us Islam's profitability, and the orange line the overall economy excluding the financial sector. For some reason, I think the color isn't too stark on the screen. So this contrasts Islam's profitability to the financial to the rest of the economy. But in doing this comparison, we must obviously bear in mind that it doesn't necessarily follow that Islam should track the rest of the economy. Islam as a civil entity has both commercial interests and commercial obligations, but also developmental obligations. But with that proviso, let's just compare Islam's profitability to the rest of the economy. We notice two distinct periods over here. One is 94 to 2006, where Islam was on average more profitable than the rest of the economy, the green line being above the orange line. And in fact, Eskom's average profit or net profit margin in this period was 11.4% compared to the rest of the economy, which was 8%. So that's interesting to note. However, it changes and it's quite a sudden and a contrast post 2007, where Eskom is a lot less profitable than the economy overall, which is rather interesting. And we see losses that in the green line below 0%. During the period of the financial crisis and the electricity crisis of 2008. Why? We'll come to this in a moment. So let's stick to discussing Eskom's profits, but now let's compare Eskom's profits to its revenue. So Eskom's profit, again, is the green line over here, and beneath that you have the gray line, and that's Eskom's revenue. Both of these figures are in constant 2015-16 rand, so you can compare them across time. It's very interesting to note that between 94 and 2007, net profit and revenue do not record significant increases. In fact, in many years, they actually decrease. So there's a rather interesting story emerging over here. Despite large and sustained increases in revenue since 2006-2007, overall, Eskom profits have been in decline.
If you'll allow me, can you just, I know the colors are not so clear,
yeah.
But just tell me that, when you say green, can you just indicate which one is the green?
Okay,
line?
Sure.
You don't mind, just check green.
I know, because
so
we don't have
the
color
copy.
Yeah.
The configuration of this bench doesn't allow me to look at the slides and the members at the same time. I would like to actually make face contact, eye contact with the members. But the green line is the one above, that's net profits, and that pertains to the left axis. And the gray line is revenue, and that pertains to the axis on the right-hand side. Right. So is that clear enough? Sure. So between 2006 and 2015-16, Eskom's revenue grows by a real annual average of 9.7%, but actually profits fall. So this is rather interesting to have a situation where revenue is growing consistently at a significant rate, but profitability actually falls. So based on this picture, that is strong revenue growth but declining profitability since 2006-2007, it would suggest that expenditure must be the determinant of this contrasting performance. So high revenue but low profitability. And there's obviously some truth to that. My colleague Siraj is going to touch on expenditure in a few moments. However, at the same time, there's a lot more to this than merely expenditure increasing faster in that period. Honourable Members, earlier on we mentioned that revenue is a function of price and quantity. So the more you're selling, the higher revenue would be, the higher the price you're selling at, the higher revenue would be. At its very basic level, it's price times quantity that gives us revenue. So we expect ESCOM's revenue to increase as the amount of electricity sold also increases. We'll also expect ESCOM's revenue to increase as the price at which it sells electricity increases. Just turn our attention to the relationship between revenue and sales, and that's what this particular graph over here shows us. The green line, that's the line on the top, gives us electricity sales, and this is an index with the sales over time. And what we notice about this is a very sudden and a significant increase from 1994 to about 2006-2007. So this is quite large. So 1994, and the reasons for this is primarily post-1994 we had significant and sustained economic growth, increasing demand for electricity. We also have the government's program to roll out electricity to houses that were not electrified pre-1994. So there's a massive electrification program that takes place, again increasing demand. You also have energy intensive sectors coming online, like which is the aluminium smelters, and many other sectors in the economy, increasing the demand for electricity. However, at the same time, and this is rather interesting, is revenue doesn't increase. So between 1994, 1995, 2006, 2007, revenue is actually pretty flat for the most part, and in certain years it actually declines. All else equal, I mean, if we would have expected revenue to increase, not remain flat. So despite a 28% increase in electricity demand between 1994 and 2006-2007, revenue actually declined by 2.8%. So this is a very, very, very interesting picture, quite peculiar, if you like. The picture reverses following 2006-2007, where ESCOM sales actually decreased. So peaking in 2006-2007, ESCOM sales have actually been on a downward trajectory. That's the green line on top, declining over the 8 years since then. So despite revenue increasing considerably, sales have actually declined. So this is, again, a bit peculiar. Why do revenues increase but sales actually decrease? So there must be more to this. And this, as you may have suspected, is primarily because of price. So let's move on to the discussion on pricing of electricity. I'd like to focus your attention on the orange bars. So for a moment, just ignore those two lines and just look at these orange bars over here, quite flat over here, and they increased quite significantly since 2008-2009. Between 1994-1995 and 2007-2008, we have a period of relatively low increases to the electricity. So these orange bars represent the year-on-year increase in the average electricity price across the economy, but you have relatively low increases. What's very interesting to point out over here is the gray line over here, the inflation or CPI for inflation. Electricity increases in many of these years actually beneath overall CPI, and that essentially means that the actual electricity price increases were negative. So you had decreasing real prices, real increases in electricity. This picture contrasts quite significantly post 2006-2007. I'm going to come to that in a moment. So why were we able to have such low increases to electricity prices between 1994 and 2006-2007? This is primarily, as Siraj alluded to earlier on, pre-1994 the South African government, and ESCOM in particular, went on a huge investment drive, and so we had significant overcapacity in terms of electricity. So we built a lot of plants across the country. There isn't the cheap coal, and so we were able to provide electricity to the markets at below cost. Consequently, South African government was able to have low inflation price increases, and at one stage, ESCOM together with the Department of Trade and Industry had actually made it their manifest objective to have real decreases in electricity prices. The objective of this was to actually attract investment, and so you had significant investment in the energy-intensive sectors. Whilst this brought a lot of investment and created some jobs and boosted exports, it wasn't sustainable, a sustainable strategy. Then come 2007, 2008, you have a significant change in the trajectory of electricity price increases. In this period, you have the creation of, or you have the passing of new legislation. One is legislation that creates NERSA. In 2006, the Energy Electricity Regulation Act was passed, and NERSA then became responsible for tariff determination. And you have very significant increases in tariffs. So the question is, why did we actually need to have such significant increases in tariffs? So why is the picture so different from here, going back and comparing it to this period over here? Let's go on to pricing. The question over here is, so why did tariffs go up? Were price increases in electricity tariffs adequate to meet the demands and the needs of ESCOM, as well as take into consideration the needs of the economy? And what has been the impact of increases in electricity tariffs on ESCOM's profits? We would have expected, with such significant increase in electricity prices, that ESCOM's profits would actually, and profitability would have improved, but that has not been the case. So to understand tariffs, we need to understand how tariffs are determined in South Africa right now. What's important to note over here is that tariffs have two major components based on the methodology. One are pass-through costs. So one is overall ESCOM expenses, like paying for coal, paying for diesel, paying for ESCOM's engineers and other employees. And that my colleague Siraj will discuss. That's the blue blocks over here. Those are pass-through costs. What I want to discuss and what affects revenue in a very significant manner is the return ESCOM is allowed on its asset base. So how the revenue formula works is ESCOM applies to NERSA for particular allowable revenue. That revenue is made up of two components. One is the return on its asset base, and two is the overall pass-through cost. So the return on its asset base is essentially a return based on a WACC, that's a cost of capital and cost of debt, based on industry specifics, multiplied by its total asset base, that's known as the RAB, its regulatory asset base. So if tariffs are adequate, then this must be sufficient to maintain ESCOM as a going concern, that allow ESCOM significant and sufficient returns to its asset base, but covering its total expenditure to ensure a financially healthy entity. In fact, the 2008 electricity pricing policy notes that ESCOM should be entitled to a sufficient return to cover its costs from its supplying electricity, as well as a fair rate of return on its asset base. Now, if we look at this here, the higher the asset base, the higher overall revenue you will be. Now, let's now hone into this year, because the regulatory asset base is a significant component of how ESCOM determines its revenue. Now, what happened, as we noted, pre-94, South Africa invested in significant generation capacity. It didn't need to invest in the early 90s until it was almost too late. And so you have the regulatory asset base not following a very typical growth trajectory. So let's look at that asset base. What we have happening is ESCOM starting very significant investments in its generation capacity around 2006, 2007. Consequently, you had its asset base increasing quite a bit. Because the asset base was much larger, this is one of the key determinants in what you observe were very high electricity prices or price increases post 2006, 2007. And if you look at this over here, ESCOM revalued its asset base based on a more modern methodology known as depreciated replacement costs. And this resulted in significantly higher electricity tariffs. So ESCOM was entitled to a return on its asset base. But what's important to note over here is the very significant and high increases in tariffs post 2007, 2008 does not give ESCOM a sufficient return. So in actual fact, if we wanted ESCOM to have healthier finances, ESCOM should have had a much larger return on its asset base. A much larger return on its asset base, so that's its asset base multiplied by the return we allow, would have resulted in a much higher tariffs post 2007, 2008. Now, the pricing policy of 2008 notes that ESCOM should go to full cost-reflective prices by 2012, 2013. That has not occurred, and obviously there are concerns surrounding this. So in the energy regulator of South Africa not giving ESCOM a full return, what it has inadvertently done, it actually affected ESCOM's overall financial position. But one must understand that not giving ESCOM a full return on its asset base will also be necessary up to a particular point to make it to ease the burden on consumers and business. So obviously, the regulator finds itself in a very tricky position over here. So with that being said, let's recap that we've noticed significant increases in revenue post 2006-2007, despite this profitability has not kept up, and this essentially has not been great for ESCOM's profitability and its financial position. My colleague Siraj is now going to focus on expenditure, but I think it's important to note at this juncture that any expensive investment in ESCOM generation technology will not be good for the overall tariff trajectory and may not be good for ESCOM's overall profitability if we consider the return on its asset base. Thank you.
Well, let me welcome Honorable Member S. Ngomo. Thank you, Ma'am. Thanks for coming. This is our meeting. We're getting a briefing from ESCOM. I'm sorry, from PBO about ESCOM finances. You emphasize ESCOM so much that I didn't think of dealing with ESCOM. Okay, no, that's fine. Sorry.
Okay, thank you very much, Chief. So, just to reiterate the point that Rashad was making, that even though there was a huge increase in ESCOM's tariff, the charges to consumers, if you look at that second last bullet point he makes, ESCOM has never been afforded a full return on its asset base. Tariffs are not cost-reflective. And and this has been the case from the 1980s. So the Villiers Commission sat from 1983 to 1985 to look at ESCOM and the problem related to the huge increases in tariffs that ESCOM was demanding at around the time when it started its new goal and afterwards through the 80s, right into the end of the 80s. And the one thing, even though they were very critical of ESCOM, they didn't recommend cost-reflective tariffs. And that was a situation that's been continuing for very long. And what that means is that over a long period of time, the income that ESCOM gets may be enough to cover operating costs and ongoing expenditures, but it isn't cognizant of the need to build new capacity. And so I remember as a quite a young man being part of the National Electrification Forum, where there was a call, this was in 1993, a call for ESCOM to move towards cost-reflective tariffs then already. But as Rashad was saying, there were real issues related to the electrification drive, the need to support the costs of businesses, and electricity then was seen as a competitive advantage for South Africa, et cetera, where decisions were made not to adequately take into account replacement costs in the future. So this is, I think, one of the really important points in this discussion, that when you're thinking about what you should charge, you shouldn't think about what your assets cost now, you should think about what it's going to cost in the future to replace that. So every unit of electricity you use, to some extent, eats up your existing capacity, and you have to cost in future what it would cost in the future into that tariff, is what the goal would be.
Sorry, Prof, when you say, I just want to understand this differently. When you say it has never been afforded a full return, afforded by?
Either by government or in more recent times, NERSA, the National Electricity Regulator. And so, I mean, at the moment there's a multi-year price determination process. And within that process, ESCOM will propose what the tariff should be based on the kind of picture Rashad showed earlier. You know, what they say the asset base is, what the return should be, the pass-through cost, and then NERSA will look at that and say, no, we think instead of 25 cents, you should get 80 cents for that, for example. And within that, I think we should remember also that ESCOM may be wanting to have a level of comfort, and also to some extent some of the inefficiencies and other problems in ESCOM may be reflected in that challenge. But the question, we'll come back to this at the conclusion, so I'm jumping to the end in a sense. The question I think for the oversight process is, even if there are large levels of efficiency that can be reduced over a period, how do you deal with that? Do you cut it into the talent? Because if you don't, you affect the viability of ESCOM as an entity. So this is also part of that issue, is, you know, is ESCOM too big to fail? I mean, how much inefficiency and other things do we have to put up with because of that? And that makes the rigor of the oversight process really important, to make sure that we're keeping ESCOM on their toes and as efficient as possible. So let me move on to talking about the expenditure side, because as Rashad was saying, you know, the one thing was that there was a shift towards considering replacement costs and more cost-reflective tariffs. On the other side, there was a huge increase in ESCOM's cost structure and expenditure. So this section is to focus on that. And to say that we focus on three drivers of ESCOM's costs. The one is coal, and just to make a point that the South African electricity supply industry is predominantly powered by coal. I'll put up a picture in a second. Two is a big driver in, at least since 2011 or 2012, has been the cost of diesel and the use of the open cycle gas turbines, or OCGTs, that have been used when we've not had sufficient output from our coal power plants to manage the peaks and to increase the amount of electricity available to the grid when demand went up. And then also the cost related to the renewable independent power producers, that now ESCOM has to buy electricity from the renewable independent power producers. That becomes an expense item for them as well. So this section provides background to the challenges faced by ESCOM and considers the impact of these rising costs at a time when large investments were made by ESCOM. These two pie charts, I'm not sure how clearly you can see them, but you do have the presentation, looks at, one is domestic coal consumption in South Africa, the first one, and we see that power generation is this, and this is from, I think, the Department of Mineral Resources 2015 report. So I think it may reflect 2014 figures, but this is the latest of this breakdown I could find, and it said 65% was from power generation. So from our consumption of coal in the country, 65% is used for electricity. I think what gives you a sense that ESCOM is still very much a coal business is that 91%, and this is actually taken, I should have put the year here, this was taken from the 2016 integrated annual report numbers, 91% of our energy sources for South African electricity production is coal-fired power stations. And we see nuclear is around about 6%. We've seen over the last few years that growth in the use of the gas turbines, the OCGTs, and we see the increases in renewables. But as a percentage of these renewables, including wind, are quite low. That's growing. Now, I'm going to go, before I go into the real issues around cost, I do want to talk a bit about the history so that we have a context for thinking about ESCOM as a very much a coal business, how the coal and electricity industry developed and evolved alongside each other. And this can also bring us into think about some of those political economy issues I spoke about. Now, the development of electricity and the coal industry from the 1970s occurred rapidly. There was a major development which was called the washing of coal, which allowed a separation of grades from run-of-the-mine coal, which created opportunities for ESCOM and the coal mines. Now, this process is basically separating us from the same mining mine product, different grades of coal. And before the 70s, this technology wasn't around. So from the 70s, we see that South Africa suddenly become a large exporter of coal and fairly high-grade coal. And what happened then is that the rest of the coal could be used by Eskom. So Eskom secured supply and supported the coal mining companies by entering into long-term cost-plus contracts. Eskom provided capital for development of the mines and took risks based on the geology of the mine. So Eskom would take 50% to 40% of the capital required to develop a mine so that they could get this long-term, you know, 40-year contract to supply coal. And often it was the power stations, new power stations were built at the coal mine, and the coal was basically fed into the power station with a conveyor belt. Right? So it was very cheap in terms of being able to use the lower grade coal, being able to save on transport costs, etc., and they had a secure supply of coal for a very long time. But so basically Eskom in signing these agreements took the risk of the operating cost of the mine. And today, again to jump to the latest part of the story, today we see that many of these cost-plus contracts, the mines, are quite old. Many of them are over 50 years old, some of them over 40, and the cost of coal mining from those mines has become more expensive, but also the grades of coal have declined over time. And so Eskom hasn't been able to get adequate supplies from these mines, but also the cost from these mines have increased, and in terms of these cost-plus contracts, Eskom takes on those cost increases. So, for instance, before the Arnett mine closed at the Arnett power station, Eskom was paying over 1,000 rand a ton because the mine was actually 40 years old, and that was what it cost to actually get coal out when the cost that you could get in the market was probably under 200 rand a ton. So you see these developments happening. But at the time when the new power plants were built and when these contracts were entered into, this was a huge opportunity both for the coal mines and Eskom. The mining companies developed new rail infrastructure with the state entities and also port facilities to export coal. So the development of the coal washing process allowed certain types of opportunities and the private sector and state-owned enterprises and governments to actually come to and do joint developments that were mutually beneficial, and also the politics at the time meant that there were opportunities as well. In the report we don't talk about BEE, but I think it's worth mentioning that at this time a lot of support for Afrikaner mining companies in coal was developed from Eskom, and Eskom basically choosing to buy coal and supporting the development of Afrikaner businesses and mining at the time when it was dominated by the English mining companies. So there is a part of that story which I think is worth talking about. And if members do want to ask more about the implications for BEE and the changes in the political economy and what's happening to the mining industry, I think we can try and cover some of that in question time. To talk more about the background, and here getting to the political economy stuff, I draw on the term minerals and energy complex to describe what people call the system of accumulation in South Africa. And this is drawn from the work of Ben Fine, an academic based at the School of Oriental African Studies at the London University, and our first post-apartheid Director General of Trade and Industry, Zab Rustenji, in a book that's become quite, I think, famous in South Africa on the minerals and energy complex. And they say that it doesn't only describe the sectors, the mining and energy and minerals processing sectors, but it also describes what they call a system of accumulation, which is this relationship between the state-owned enterprises and private sector that shape economic outcomes in South Africa. They say that the evolution of the minerals and energy complex requires quite close coordination between these actors. The investments in Eskom, the increased exports of coal, the development of the state coal railway line, the privately owned coal terminal, supported the benefits gained from coal washing. ESCOM saw itself as integrally linked to the mining industry and to ensure adequate electricity supply to the mining and minerals processing sector. In some work looking at the history of ESCOM, when people, like the former CEO of ESCOM was interviewed, he actually says, and we quote in the paper, that you know ESCOM actually saw itself as integrally tied, and the content and management of their culture was linked to them seeing themselves as providing enough electricity to keep the mines running and for the expansion in the mining industry. So this notion of an MEC, I think, is not just a theoretical concept, but it's something we can see. Now, during the 70s, we saw rapid growth of ESCOM was confronted with increasing demand. Now, a lot of people, when they hear the MEC and the evolution and growth of coal mining and electricity, think that, therefore, ESCOM was on a very profitable trajectory, that they were efficient, that they were growing well, but there were very real challenges to ESCOM in this process of rapid growth, bringing on new technologies. And I think the important thing about understanding the building of coal, of power stations, whether it's coal, nuclear, or any other of those very large-scale power stations, is that they have very long lead times. They often are delayed. In our presentation, when we spoke about energy choices, I think we had figures on this, so we didn't repeat that. But I think members have been exposed to those kind of arguments before. And that the costs are expensive. And we're actually seeing that with Mazupi and Kusile, the new coal-fired power stations today. But they are running late. They are ending up taking more than 10 years to bring online. Now I think the expectation is that by 2021, the final units will come into operation. And so we saw similar problems in the 1970s. Now, the response from ESCOM, and especially given that culture of supplying as much electricity as was needed, especially from the coal mining and the mineral beneficiation sectors, was to build enough capacity to meet the demand. They had rapid upscaling of generation capacity. It put pressure on ESCOM's resources and skills. It built up pressure on ESCOM's finances. There's a large increase in debt. I spoke about the long lead times, but the long lead times mean that a significant amount of your capital, whether through debt or whether it's your saved money that you got from revenues and your shorter profits, end up going into the construction process, not providing more capacity at the given time. So there's those kinds of issues as well, in terms of you've got a lot of capital invested in an ongoing concern. Once those concerns are online, it eases your problems, but while you're building it, it actually puts pressure on your financial viability, and it poses risks to your financial viability. ESCOM at the time increased borrowing, but we see, and I spoke about the Villiers Commission, they were forced to increase tariffs significantly during that period to cover the ongoing costs. So I think I raised this in the history of ESCOM because I think there are lots of lessons for us to draw from that history in the current process. Now, ESCOM's management at the time was more concerned with financial management than ensuring the efficiency of the system. So what happened was ESCOM and the Villiers Commission criticized ESCOM modeling of what electricity demand would be, and the ESCOM ended up creating a huge overcapacity. Now, when an entity like ESCOM has a large overcapacity, they then have some room to play with, and they're not worried that much about the efficiency of their plant and meeting demand. They're sitting with a huge amount of debt, and they just want to pay down that debt. And so management was more focused on the financial management rather than the efficiency of plants. They had overcapacity, and they ended up actually mothballing some power stations, which we then, in the post-apartheid period, brought back online when we started facing shortages in electricity. And as we said, the tariffs were not cost-reflective, and part of the problem of not having cost-reflective tariffs is that it steers the economic development of the country towards more energy intensity. And as I said, ESCOM Supercell really much aligned to mining and minerals processing and keeping the tariffs not cost reflective, even though there were demands for increasing tariffs, meant that, you know, it steered the economy in a certain direction. In economics, we often talk about path dependency. And so the structure of the South African economy today is one where we have fairly capital-intensive, energy-intensive, and not labor-intensive manufacturing and other capacity in the economy, and that there's a need to actually shift from that. But it also meant that many of the people who had access to electricity at the time had no incentive to use it, or didn't have as much incentive to use electricity as sparingly as they should have, as tariffs were cost reflective. And so people were running pool pumps and other fairly luxury uses of electricity grew a lot, and people not being concerned with energy efficiency. And I mean, Eskom, through the 90s even, when we realized that we would need new capacity, but electricity prices were still low, I don't think we spent enough energy focusing on demand side management, increasing the efficiency within society on the use of electricity. I think it was only in the late 90s that they started handing out these energy efficient light bulbs, promoting use of solar for heating, etc. So we see that the not having cost reflective status had a huge impact on the shape of the economy. Now, from the 2000s, the overcapacity and rapid tariff increases did allow Eskom to be able to pay down their debt, and as you're saying, keeping prices low and not cost effective. And I think the one thing, even though we sound very critical about Eskom, I think it's important to acknowledge that they played a really important role in electrification and other development issues within the country in that time, and that actually did add to the costs as well. From the 2000s, we start seeing increased demand for electricity in response to rapid global and domestic economic growth and electrification, and this is a point that Rashad made, so I won't go into that in more detail. At the same time, the age of the mines and the electricity generation capacity meant that we started getting reduced quantity of coal, and the efficiency of the plants was in decline. And because I think we weren't getting the cost reflective tariffs, there was a backlog in terms of maintenance. There still is, I think, a fairly significant backlog in maintenance that Eskom is trying to catch up. And it means taking a large part of your capacity offline for months at a time, which then creates pressure and the risk of load shedding. So Eskom is sort of doing as a balancing act in terms of keeping the lights on and proper maintenance of the plants. There are other issues with maintenance that I think you mentioned in the paper. So Eskom's costs increased. We saw from the 2000s, the cost of labor, water, and other costs, the spending on maintenance and property, plant, and equipment rose, the primary energy costs, particularly coal, but also other inputs rose significantly. And then from 2011-12, the diesel costs rose significantly because the gas turbines were used to ensure peak demand was supplied. So here we go back to the numbers. So I'm switching from my economist hat back to my accounting hat in this discussion. Okay. I can actually use So this is just looking at selected expenditure items. The dark line is the primary energy cost. Now this is an index that we developed using 1997, the first year, and this is actually because it was very difficult to get data going back and actually compiling it and putting it together in a coherent form where they, you know, the different years actually mean the same thing. So we went back the year to 1997, and the index started at 100. So what we can see is that through to about 2006, 2007, there is an increase of about 50% in the costs of our primary energy costs, and then we see that, especially from 2008, this rapid increase by about 600%, right, six times, up to 2015, and then there's a slight decline from 2016. The second lighter line, this one, I'll start at the end this time over here, is the cash spent on plant, property, and equipment, and this increases related to also new spending on power stations, but also linked to increasing maintenance costs as the plant is getting older and Eskom is forced to start putting the auditors into maintenance. And we see from 2006 onwards a rapid increase from about three times, and it sort of stabilizes through the period from 2009. This last line is labor costs, and we see that from 2000 as well, labor costs from what 2006 starts increasing and about double, and we see that the wage increases on average in Eskom have been above the inflation level, and I think from the union side there's been an argument that workers were underpaid for a really long time and there's a need to catch up, especially in mining and related sectors, and this reflects some of that and the demand for that. Now, if we think about what contributes to primary energy costs, this I took from the 2016 annual report. On the right side, we've got 2015-16. On the left side, we've got 2014-15. And we see that coal is a major contributor to primary energy costs. We see over time that as I said, especially from 2011-2012, the use of the gas turbines, that increases a lot. And then we see especially under other ship, which I think a lot, the blue one here, this one, is your independent power producers, and you see that increasing from 2014-15 to 2015-16. So as the contracts get signed for the provision of renewable energy into Eskom's grid and them paying the renewable energy producers for that, we see that contributing to the primary energy cost as well and increasing contribution. Now, if we, again, using an index starting with 1997 as 100, if we look at the primary energy costs and the thermal coal price in South Africa, we find that for the period from 97 to around 2006-07, before the financial crisis, that those prices do increase. The prices of coal increase, and with that, the energy cost increases. And then around the time of the crisis, the primary energy cost increased as well. But we see from especially 2011, after 2011, this rapid increase here, right, that much steeper increase. And that's related to the cost of diesel for gas turbines. And that is from basically keeping the lights on, saying you see peak demand going up and Eskom having to meet that. If we look at the profitability of Eskom, before that I'll just show you how much Eskom was spending over this period backwards, so it's 2013-14, 2014-15, 2015-16. We see that they were spending in 2013-14 about 10 billion rand on diesel, and that does improve a bit, but even by 2015-16 it was still very high. That was a huge increase, and that was basically Eskom trying to reduce load shedding, and in discussions with people who know the industry, we were told that ESCOM basically, we saw in that period, 2013-14, 2014-15, some load shedding, and ESCOM was basically using up as much of its operating margins to pay for diesel, and when they realized that they weren't going to break even, that they were going to be pushed into negative territory, they would actually then move on to load shedding and pass on the cost basically to the consumers who lost money because they didn't have access to electricity, especially businesses. So this was a really difficult period, and ESCOM using its role and ability to load shed as a way of ensuring that they didn't have losses, but passing on those costs to the economy. Now, if we look at climate costs, and these are real in 2010 prices, the column, these bars, the columns are your primary energy real costs, and again, it's the same, and it's the same thing as before. It's been, especially from 2008, that rapid increase, and then from 2011, that steeper increase. And if you compare that to the primary cost as a percentage of ESCOM's revenue, we see that increasing in line with that. So basically, by 2015-16, the primary energy cost is half of ESCOM revenue. So it's seriously eating into ESCOM's bottom line, let's say. And this graph shows if we break up ESCOM's revenue into its primary energy cost, all its other operating costs, and then look, see the difference between that as the operating profit, so the difference between the revenue and primary energy cost plus operating cost, we'll see, so the it's difficult to see it on the board, but if you look at the light green bar right on top, so each of these columns are three parts, right? The bottom part is your primary energy cost, which you know the trend now increases. We see that operating costs actually become a smaller share as your primary energy costs increase, because these are all out of 100, right, percentages. So if the one increases, the other one is proportionally going to decrease. But what we're seeing is that during this period, especially if you look at 2015, that the operating profit decreases during this period. So we see this trend on ESCOM, ESCOM financials related very much to the primary energy cost. I'm going to pass on to
okay, good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, together with colleagues. I will take over from here and focus on capital. We've covered ESCOM's income and expenditure patterns, and now we focus on capital, which I refer to as the engine of the business. I refer to it as the engine of the business because without sufficient capital, you have nothing to invest on your capital assets, and if you don't have sufficient capital assets, then you can't have sufficient revenue, and therefore you will not have good profits. Okay, so capital can be in the form of equity or debt. This is of particular importance as well for government because it's the primary shareholder, and ESCOM relies heavily on government for financial support, be it in the form of loans, of equity, or of guarantees. And striking a balance between the two, being capital and, sorry, equity and debt, sets a tone for the health of an entity's capital structure. ESCOM's long-term debt has steadily been on the rise over the years, particularly over the past decade. As you can see on the left axis, it is steadily increasing from the 1980s to 2016, and that is a result of the capital bills, as my colleagues have alluded to, including operating costs, particularly maintenance of infrastructure and other operating costs. We show the increase of the debt on the left axis. In 2016, we were sitting at over 300 billion in debt with Eskom. On the right axis, we compare the equity versus the debt in Eskom. The relationship between debt and equity generally indicates that a company has been aggressive in financing its growth with debt. So you don't really want a high debt to equity ratio. A debt to equity ratio greater than 2 indicates a risky scenario for the investor. Eskom's debt to equity ratio for 2016 was at 1.67 compared to 2.53 in 2015. So there is an improvement in the capital structure, and that is a result mostly of the capital injection that happened in 2016 to the value of 23 billion. Okay. Now, given the high debt levels in Eskom, it is useful to evaluate Eskom's ability to repay such a debt. We compare earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortization to debt to verify Eskom's ability to pay its debts. We use the income before tax, depreciation and amortization because this is seen as the core income of an entity, as it excludes non-monetary expenses together with the cost of tax and the cost of debt. Now, it goes without saying that the payment terms of the debt will also play a role in the entity's ability to repay the debt. Now, unfortunately for our analysis, we did not have access to the information on the repayment terms on the debt, particularly with, the debt with government. A declining debt to EBITDA ratio is preferred over an increasing one because it implies that the entity is paying off its debt and or growing earnings. So this is the ratio that we used to evaluate Eskom's ability to repay such a debt. Eskom's debt reached its peak in 2015 where it exceeded 12. But we see that in 2016 it actually improved, going back to just over 10. And again, this is a reflection of the loan that was converted into equity amounting to 60 billion. So the trend of what I've just been going through indicates that Eskom relies heavily on government for financial assistance in guarantees and in loans, and in those loans again being converted into equity. Now the question is sustainability. Until when are we going to feed the beast? I've been focusing on plainly debt. I will now expand my discussion to liabilities. Liabilities include debts but are not only restricted to debt. That being said as well, liabilities, the biggest chunk of Eskom liabilities comprises of the debt, but this includes employee obligation benefits, trade creditors, etc. Eskom's total liabilities have steadily been on the increase over the past 10 years. If you look on the graph from 1997, you can see that steadily we are increasing. Comparing 2006 to 2016. In 2006, we were sitting with 77 billion in total liabilities, which has increased to a staggering 480 billion in 2016. The interim financial statements for 2017, which reflect what has happened with Eskom until the end of September 2016, reflect total liabilities of 502 billion. Now, as already indicated, Eskom relies heavily on government financial backing, be it in the form of guarantees, loans or equity. Only in 2016, we've already had an equity injection of 23 billion. We had a shareholder loan converted to equity amounting to 60 billion. And we had out of the 350 billion contingent liabilities available, 160 billion had already been used. It is worthy to note that Eskom takes up over 70% of the total SOE guarantee portfolio. That is over 70% for one entity. Now, with such a high liability level and such high reliance on state guarantees, auditors and other stakeholders will continue to question the going concern status of Eskom. And I suspect that government will find itself in a position where it has to continue funding Eskom. Now the question is that the direction we want to take? And what interventions can be put in place to improve efficiencies within Eskom? Again, with this heavy reliance on government funding, coupled with the uninviting credit ratings in the recent past, particularly in 2016, external lenders are bound to be skeptical to fund Eskom, and they will continue to seek guarantees in case something goes wrong, in case Eskom is unable to repay the loans. Although liabilities are on the rise, as reflected on the graph, it is also useful to think about what this means to the fiscus, as I've already said. For example, the conversion of the shareholder loan to equity means that interest income has been foregone. We should have gotten interest income, but because now it's no longer a loan, it's equity, we will not be getting that interest income. Also important to loan is that loan financing by government weakens the government's financial position and guarantees increase contingent liabilities for government. Right, so we have looked at liabilities and the level of cost. Now let's look at what it costs to actually finance these high levels of debt. It obviously becomes costly when an entity relies heavily on debt to maintain liquidity, because the more you borrow, the more interest you need to pay. Over 50% of profits generated by Eskom go directly towards the financing of debt. 50% of profits made go to debt. As we already heard, Eskom's profitability has been in a decline over the years, with debt financing contributing significantly to these expenses. Now again, the question is, yes, we want to push on revenue, but what are we doing with this revenue generated? If 50% is going towards debt financing, what are we chasing? Now, I looked at the interim financial statement for 2017, and I noticed that there's a significant increase in debt financing. In 2016, it was sitting at 5 billion. And within the 6 months of 2017, already we are sitting at 9.3 billion. That's almost double of what it was in 2016. We will have to wait and see until the end of March to see what the total figure will come to. Okay, now we've seen the cost of debt. I thought it would be interesting to see how able Eskom is to actually repay the debt or the interest, therefore. What we use to do that is what we refer to as the interest cover ratio. It essentially looks at the level of interest, and it also looks at your income levels. The lower the ratio, the more the entity is burdened by the debt expense. And when the company's interest coverage ratio is only 1.5 or lower, its ability to meet interest expenses may be questionable. Now, as you can see, we are almost within the danger zone of 1.5. Now the question is, you have interest to pay, but are you able to pay that interest? And if you are not, then what happens? More funding from government. Okay, I will hand back to my colleague Siraj. Thank you.
Okay, the signs of a good accountant is somebody that sobers you up, right? You just, suddenly you know the realities of thinking of this. So we're really happy to have some really good accountants on our team at TBI. So when you hear from me, it's much more as an economist, somebody who takes a more kind of abstract look at the world and macro. And the accountants actually shake us up and say, just look at this really what's happening. So now I think we've all gotten that wake up call.
You're the dreamer, she's the realist.
Professor, I must say that I promise you from where I'm sitting, I then started feeling some discomfort by living. You may proceed.
So I think what I tried to do before when talking about the history was to show that, you know, the problems we face in ESCOM today isn't just a problem of the last 10 years and poor management and inefficiency, but it's a long-term period where we have, I mean, about half of our generation capacity is about 30 years old or more, right? The coal mines that we had, the cost-plus contracts, were also very old. So ESCOM had to source more and more of its coal from long-term contracts and even short-term contracts. The freight costs, because they're not at the mine, they can't be moved into the mine by conveyor belt, add to the cost. And then, as I said, we had a period where, because of our old mines, and the low-quality coal, because of the old plants and the backlog of maintenance, we saw that we needed to use diesel, a very expensive way of generating electricity to ramp up so we could actually meet demand. And even then, we were faced with load shedding. So we're sitting with a problem today based on a long-term problem, but we actually are the ones who have to deal with the problem and figure out how to fix it. We've got new capacity coming online, but it's been delayed, and that adds to the cost as well. The next slide, and leading the conclusion, is to say that at the moment things do look bad, and financially things are very tight, but that we may actually face further risks that I think we need to take into consideration in terms of oversight of ESCOM and what that means in terms of how we approach ESCOM in terms of thinking about our long-term energy security. And as I said, considering ESCOM as something that may be too big to fail. Now, the coal security of supply and energy security. In 2013, there was something called the South African Coal Roadmap developed, and it was linked to concerns about the supply of coal, adequate levels of supply of coal. And they estimated a shortage of coal of about 60 megatons per annum. The graph on the right is a graph taken actually from an ESCOM presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprise in 2013. And it shows you that if you look at the dark blue part, that what they've contracted, and we see that from 2018, that's starting to decline. The amount that they've got contracted in terms of the cost-plus mines and the long-term contracts basically goes down, and by 2025 we actually see things that go even further down, and ESCOM's estimating the possibilities of 40 megatons for generation shortages per annum from the early 2020 period. Now there is the possibility of large new coal production in the Waterberg, but there will be an increase in coal prices due to transport. Now, The IFP for that 2016 update assumes a price of 450 rand per ton, and that's compared to the 2013 update that had a price of 350 rand per ton. So to some extent, the integrated resource plan has made a big increase to the cost of coal in the assumptions about the future and the planning. But for me, the big question is, are we actually going to get the coal mines developed? Is there going to be adequate investment? Because there needs to be a large amount of investment in new coal mines to meet the estimated shortfalls in coal over the period. So for us, that could end up being a fairly important risk, and that may add to Eskom's final energy costs again in the future. Also, a shortage in coal may mean that they would have to resort to using those gas turbines again. Eskom is in the process of upgrading those turbines to be able to use gas as well, so either diesel or gas, but it also depends on the ability to secure enough gas supplies. And so I couldn't find out when doing this research whether Eskom has managed to tie down gas contracts for the OCGT and what the cost implications of that would be. But given that we have had a unit of Medupi come online, that has eased to some extent the need to use the OCGT to supply. So we are seeing the cost of diesel to Eskom, or the expense of diesel from Eskom, declining from the second half of 2016. So in the 2017 report, I think we should see, annual report, we should see that diesel costs have made a much smaller contribution to primary costs, and that could cause an improvement. And as new capacity does come online from Maduka to Sile, we do expect the problems with adequate supply and needing to use gas turbines to meet that, if the ramp up goes successfully, to come down. So that could create a slight improvement for Eskom's those ratios we're talking about as well. Now this other part is much more thinking about what's going to happen to utilities like Eskom. And this it was hard to do this kind of research on Eskom and utilities and thinking about the utility model without coming across a large literature. And if you actually go on Google and you just put in the term electricity utility and disruption, you'll see the Lloyds and Touche and Price Waterhouse and all the consulting, the large companies, accounting consulting type companies, talking about disruption in the power sector. And there's been some interesting papers, and I quote some of the first papers, but also ongoing discussion about this in the section that deals with this in the report. And what we're seeing is what people are saying is that the current utility model of large-scale thermal power generation is over a century old, and it has matured basically about 50 years ago. And so the term disruption is being used more and more to describe the changes in the power sector globally that could be mean problems and possibly the replacement of this kind of utility model with a new model of electricity supply. And this is really important for us in thinking about Eskom as we move into the future, because we've got this huge asset. We've invested a huge amount in this asset. We don't want this asset to fail, but it could be faced with more and more problems, and we're seeing that reflected in utilities around the world, in developed and developing countries, that the pressures of these changes are affecting them and the way they operate. And so I think it's important to warn members that in thinking about Eskom and planning for the future, we need to take also a longer term perspective in thinking about how we manage Eskom and whether we may be managing Eskom downwards in a sense, as Eskom starts may have to play a smaller and smaller role in electricity supply. But that, those are the uncertainties we have about the future. So one is They've been so when people talk about disruption, often the first thing that comes up is a rapid decrease of insights and the amount of increased installed capacity of renewable energies in both developed and developing countries. Now, I talk about this more in the paper, but just to highlight, during 2015 and 2016, we saw more new capacity from renewables than any other source. So the new build, especially in developed countries, but across the globe, in several developing countries, has been that the new electricity generation added in countries has been more renewable than other sources. We're also seeing increases in renewables associated with large increases in employment, and the USA now employs more people in renewables than in all fossil fuels combined. So the renewables industry also has the potential to create large numbers of jobs in construction and other sectors. The second area linked to this is rapid progress in large-scale storage. And large-scale storage prices haven't come down as fast as renewable energy prices, but there are predictions that many of the large companies around the world, like Tesla and others, are putting a huge amount of money into large-scale storage technology and investment. And so you may be able to have utility size or batteries, basically. So one of the problems with having renewables is that if it's not windy or it's not sunny, you don't produce enough electricity. But if you link renewables with large-scale storage, you can actually, when it's very sunny and windy, you can store that electricity and use that to top up when you don't have the enough sun or wind or whatever your source is. Then the second big disruptor that will become very clear over the current period over the last few years is that, I mean, it's been often seen as a disruptor across many industries, but this is this application of big data. Basically being able to take and processing power and the technologies to use information about individuals or a household has increased. You can actually create a profile of a household and millions of households and use it for demand, for instance in electricity, for demand side managing. And your ability to manage your supply and demand of electricity become hugely sophisticated in that process. And this one of the questions is, what does this mean for building, for instance, coal or nuclear plants that have 10-year lead times? So basically you have the ability to manage your electricity grid and demand and supply of electricity in a country over region on a second basis, but you're still in an old utility model where it takes you 10 years, you think there's going to be an increased demand in the future, but it takes you 10 years to build something to meet that demand. And so the thinking is that the future of grid systems seems to be decentralized, digitalized and dynamic. And here this issue of digitalized is also combined with big data seems to be one of the major changes that's going to affect the way in which utilities operate or the competitors to utilities. Integrated systems management to develop digitalized grids and to some extent what people are calling self-healing grids. Now the operation and management of an electricity grid, the whole transmission system and distribution system, is a very costly and difficult process. But as computerization and digitalization and the application of big data into these systems happen, you can actually have real-time management and understand what's happening and predict demand in over a very short period, sort of almost in real-time, in terms of managing those grids, and it's becoming a more and more of an automated process, and that can link very closely to the use of new technologies and different technologies, but also across, you know, thousands of kilometers, you can have a grid, and when people talk about the self-healing grid, is they almost have an analogy with the human body, where if there's a problem in the one part of the grid, if there's an infection or cut in one part of your body, the whole body will basically be aware of it and focus on dealing with that one problem in that part of the body, and basically seeing the human body as a system, as a self-healing system in that sense. You know, sometimes you need outside to come in and help and see a doctor, but you have a capacity within the grid to actually understand what's happening everywhere and to almost manage the self-healing process. So this is, the reason I put this here is that a lot of this is not science fiction. A lot of this is happening today. A lot of these applications are happening either in tests or been implemented on at some scale. And so people are seeing these as huge things that affect you know, the viability of utilities and the old utility model. Now, linked to this, we're already starting to see financial woes globally across the world. Now, not all these financial woes are linked to this disruption, right? A lot of it is linked to the kind of problems we actually saw in ESCOM. Not having cost-effective tariffs, problems with old plants. In many countries, like South Africa, a lot of the coal and other generation capacity is quite old. Now, there's a study from the World Bank Independent Evaluation Group of 2016, and they were looking at developing countries, and they took a sample of what they described as 40 leading power utilities across developing countries, and they found that of those, only 10 were profitable. The report in 2013 of Uri Electric, which is an association of the electricity utilities across Europe, they found, and looking over more than a decade, they found that operating margins in electricity utilities across Europe were in decline. What we're seeing in China, for instance, is that China announced in January 2017 that it would cancel the building of 103 coal-fired power stations across 13 provinces. These were coal-fired power stations that had already started construction on. And they realized that there were inefficiencies, oversupplies, they were worried about adequate coal supply, and also, at the same time, they were making decisions that by 2020 they were going to spend $360 billion on renewable energy power sources. And so they were seeing renewable energy as filling a gap. So China and India have had some of the most rapid growth of building of power stations historically in any country. But I think in the current period they're realizing that they've actually overinvested in coal and fire power stations and in China it's gone to the point where they actually stop those that are already being built. Now, with this big investment in renewables, it doesn't mean renewables are suddenly going to be bigger than coal in China. China is still going to probably be like South Africa, where the majority, 80% or more of the electricity is going to come from coal, but we are seeing them taking a serious move into renewables, not only for their energy security, but also because they're starting to see themselves as a major player globally in the renewables energy industry. And they see it as almost part of an industrial strategy to support that. And also renewables is one place where you create huge amounts of jobs in electricity. With India, we saw that, again, India, like China, had massive investments in coal. In the report, when we talk about electricity prices, we actually see there was a shift in South African exports from during that mid-2000s period. Before that, we were exporting high-grade coal to Europe and Japan. When we saw the Chinese and the Indian economies take off and basically create trade surpluses against countries like the US and Europe, their demand for electricity and for coal increased. And India was actually sourcing a lot of the coal from South Africa, driving up the coal prices here. And our exports of coal switched from high-grade coal to low-grade coal, the kind of coal used in India and other parts of Asia in power generation. And we were exporting less of the high-grade coal. And if we expand our coal terminals we created a situation where we could actually export more coal, and Eskom, faced with the possibility of a declining coal supply in the future, could face challenges as well. Now, what's happening with India is that we're seeing huge losses in the generation and distribution sector. They've actually set up, government set up a fund to bail out many of the distributors, because many of the distributors, which are privately run, owe money to the generators, and so the generators are facing financial problems. And their problems, again, was linked to coal supplies, non-cost effective tariffs, etc. And what we're seeing in India is that even coal power stations that were set up to work off imported coal are now running at 50% capacity just because they don't have enough coal. And the Indian Minister of Energy announced, I think it was 2 years ago, that they actually in the next 10 years, when you were speaking 2 years ago, over that decade, they wanted to double the amount of coal produced in India to make them self-reliant coal and not to import as much coal. So we're seeing these kind of problems facing not only South Africa, but globally, places like India and China. But the problems in these countries are related. So if India's facing a shortage of coal, it puts pressure on our prices for coal. And some of our coal mines may actually have an incentive to export more of the coal that is commonly mined to places like India. So overall, the problems in electricity utilities seem systemic and may indicate that the old utility model that dominated over the past 100 years may be in trouble. So how should South Africa respond to this notion of disruption and other problems? How should South Africa manage a large utility whose value to the country seems unquestionable when that utility may continue to have poor financial performance? The adoption of the changes that could be disruptive to the electricity supply industry in South Africa could be negatively affected by policies and regulations. In the short run, some of these decisions may seem to benefit Eskom's viability and South Africa's energy security. However, a short-term perspective could tie South Africa into a road of part dependence based on an outdated electricity utility model that could be a burden on the economy and future generations. So, you know, we really needed to increase our capacity when we made those large investments in Kusile and Mazuki, but if we almost with hindsight look at it now and what's happening in the electricity industry, it's like we were buying typewriters when the world was moving towards computers. You know, and this is a very real problem. So the issue is, how do we manage it? And in the paper I compared to the disruption caused by cell phones to the telecoms industry, you know, and what happened to cell phones. So we need to think about, I think, in our oversight, think about, you know, can we develop a vision, a longer-term vision for thinking about a utility like Eskom that's usually valuable to us, but also in how we manage it, given all these changes that we're being faced. So conclusion, sorry, I've actually got more conclusion slides than usual because of these issues that are maybe worth reflecting back on the issues again. So in the short term, Eskom seems able to manage their finances adequately. So we saw that even though their liquidity ratio is not where we want it to be, that they are able to pay back their debt. But there are so many uncertainties, such as the possibility of further delays in the new build, shortages in supply of coal, etc., that increase risk to Eskom and Eskom's bottom line and ability to service their debt in the medium term. There are also large risks in the global economy that could affect South Africa and Eskom. These risks reduce the narrow space that Eskom has for managing its finances. Eskom may need further large increases in tariffs to manage any of these risks and if any of these risks negatively affect the revenue that costs, it could cause a problem. So just to expand on this point, you know, so as risks increase, and if you think about Eskom possibly as something that we really need too big to fail, either the state has to step up with more money or we charge more for tariffs. Those are the choices. And we have to keep the facility running. We have to, but also when we have it running, we need to actually be very clear about how we want it to be managed and run, and in that oversight process. But it seems with a utility like ESCOM that has a very strong monopoly position, that we have a very constrained portfolio of choices. And with that, the state may have to provide further equity injections or guarantees. So, as I've said this several times, the current situation is one where ESCOM, because of its importance, the South African economy seems almost too big to fail. This status means that, as in the past, there could be a moral hazard problem where ESCOM's management could incur large costs and risks that lead to an oversupply of electricity, but they do not bear the full cost of taking on those risks. I mean, the full cost is with the consumer and with the fiscus. And so, in the thinking about this, how do we reduce this moral hazard problem? In economics, a moral hazard problem is where, and we saw it with the financial crisis, where it's in the interest of the banks and the financial sector to take huge amounts of risk because the rewards that they get are high. But once they fail, the state has to step in and bail them out. And so they don't actually bear the full cost. The taxpayers bore the full cost. And similar with ESCOM is that there is a moral hazard problem. There could also be a risk that ESCOM, as in the past, focuses on managing their finances. But because we think as the new generation capacity comes online in the next few years, they are seeing the possibility of an overcapacity. And because of this overcapacity, they then again won't necessarily have sufficient incentive to manage the efficiency of their plant adequately. And also, sometimes with overcapacity, it becomes in the interest of government and the utilities to not have fully cost-effective tariffs. Because say, well, we've got an overcapacity, we need to sell more electricity, maybe we should keep the price lower, but also we don't want to burden business and households with that price. And so we may end up not going by our policy to have cost-reflective tariffs and to be concerned about future replacement costs. In the longer term, there are big questions about the future of utilities and whether and how they adapt to possibly disruptive changes. Now, policymakers will seriously have to discuss their future vision of the South African electricity supply industry. South Africa has large sunk capital in ESCOM and needs for energy security. At the same time, choices with regard to ESCOM today can constrain the country's options in the future given massive changes in the global electricity sector. And then going back to the political economy issues, the Middleton Energy Complex grew because there was cooperation between government, SOEs, and the private sector. The lesson from the last phase of ESCOM's growth was that it was costly and inefficient and led to an overcapacity. So even though there was good cooperation and certain parts of businesses developed and the economy developed a certain structure, you know, it wasn't necessarily good for ESCOM itself and for our situation today. But also we see today the MEC is different and the strategic role of ESCOM in real restructuring the economy must be discussed, not just increasing capacity. Now when we say the MEC is different, what we've seen through the 90s and the 2000s is that the large players, especially in mining and mineral processing, have shifted, they've restructured, they've unbundled, they've rebundled, they actually have a large amount of their business outside of South Africa now. A big group like Anglo American that used to be involved in manufacturing, retailing, newspaper publishing, etc., is now focused on three or four minerals. They see themselves as a company whose core business is just mining, and they spread across the world. They're not as reliant on South Africa anymore for their income and not necessarily as committed to supporting energy security and growth in South Africa as they were before. And so there may not be as much space and room for that cooperation between the state and the private sector. And we're seeing some of this tension play out again in discussions about DE and wanting to increase equity. And so the previous way the MEC worked, there was actually support for development of Africana mining, coal mining. It actually supported that because there were mutual benefits and because the many of the coal mines and operators were bound largely to South Africa. Now there's that shift and the commitment to the change, to the impact of BE and what that may mean for them aren't as prevalent. And that's something you also have to think about. So So the issue is, given all these kinds of issues, we've got the bottom line, we've shown the financial, the risky financial situation, but there are a huge number of other issues when we think about ESCOM in its future that also have discussed it. So I'm going to end there, and I'm sure there are lots of questions.
Thank you
very much for this opportunity.
Yeah, wow. what an insightful presentation. I'm telling you, just shaking us from our comfort room. Indeed, I'm now opening for clarity-seeking questions and discussion. Honourable Member Schopestole, Honourable Member McLaughlin, Honourable Member Dr. Peak, Honourable Member Languini, Honourable Member Dr. Madoka, and Honourable Member Manana, Honourable Member in that order. But you must then help us, ne? When you speak, can you please be short and to the point, so that we allow them enough time to respond as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be short as you know me. I'm never long. Thank you so much for this wonderful lecture. I call it a lecture. I've learned, because I'm so ignorant about this thing, you know, energy. But now I have seen a little bit. If you can explain to me exactly what you mean by renewable energy, what falls under that category? If you can supply us with some of the things that you have read, 40 readings, our utilities in the future, so that we actually read, and then the 2013, you say you're electric something. Yeah, those ones, I find them very interesting. But I just want to say to you, I agree with you a little bit on the saying that you're too big to fail, and you gave the instance of the 2008 bank that Obama actually dished out money to. I think it was good for to bail out the bank. But I don't think it was correct to reward the corrupt bankers, because they came out with billions. And what were they rewarded for? At this committee, we would expect consequence for wrongdoing. They blew the whole world into this crisis. We're suffering today because of them, but they got bonuses. And I call that corruption of the high order.
Thank you very much. Maybe for control purposes, can we ask three questions and then we will get another part. Three questions per member. Next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've just considerably constrained me. Thank you for the presentation. My first comment is, now I know why Brian Malefi left. He was bailing out. And I think with good reason. Look, there's a lot in here to absorb and all that. My sort of main picture at the moment is the following. Coal supplies aren't going to last forever. So as they dwindle, the price is going to go up. Make it more and more costly to run what we're running already. We've got Medupi and Fasupi that are, but maybe one day we'll come online, we don't know. But at the moment, we're sitting with a position where I argue strongly against converting 60 billion rand from loan to an equity. We keep pumping money into Eskom. We gave them the 23 billion shortly after that. Within 6 months, they were in China borrowing more money. I think they borrowed another 10 billion in China. And we can see why we've had this sudden, very sharp increase in their debt costs. Now, Eskom is going to run out of the capacity to supply power at any cost just now, because if they keep pushing up their prices, nobody will buy it because they can't afford it. Leaving us with carrying the can, because we're going to have all these guarantees that we're going to have to meet, we're going to have to somehow find the money to pay for all Eskom's waste and everything they've done. Now, that's my biggest concern in this picture, because what do we do then? I mean, it's all very well, by then we're going to have to find some other way, the renewable energy sources or nuclear power, whatever it might be, but we're still going to be sitting with this huge burden. Nobody's going to want to buy Eskom at this stage. You can't nationalize it or unnationalize it, because nobody wants to buy it. Who's going to buy a thing like this? We've got huge cost problems, no future in it. It's a dwindling asset, and we're going to sit with this huge infrastructure that we can do nothing with. It's really sad. Shouldn't we be cutting our losses now somehow and deciding, well, let's pull the plug on Eskom and plow the money rather into discovering other ways of producing what we need at a better cost? So that's my main question. My second question then is just, there's nothing in here that tells us what Eskom has done with all this money. And that's my huge concern. We haven't had value for the $60 billion. They borrowed it and they never told us what they did with it. And then they want to convert it from a loan to equity. But we wondered, what happened to it? What did you do with it? It was enough money to buy every single family in this country a generator and a year's worth of fuel to run the generator with. What did they do with it? It just vanished. And then they wanted more and they want more. And we still don't know what they're doing with it. I don't know whether it's any part of anything, but was any study done? I know this whole thing was based on the fellow from England, from the British University, who sits at Wits and does the study. I forget his name. But has he done? Okay, but I don't know whether any study has been done anywhere as to what became of the money. What was it spent on? I know Eskom has a huge staff complement and huge wage bill and all that, but that should be covered by the operating revenue, if I can call it that, the money that they get for selling the electricity. I mean, and I know it's the limited amount they get because it's not cost reflective, but it must cover something to an extent, but they keep needing more to fund the rest of it. And have we actually got any value for any of that? I think I'll leave it at there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Next.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I believe, just as an introduction, that this presentation was done by in two parts, one by an economist representing Eskom, and the other, which is your financial accountant, which is representing the real facts that we actually want.
How reliable is your information?
So, Chair, okay, just quickly, I'm wanting to just make sure that I speak within my time period. Now, slide number 11 deals with this formula and the determinant of your selling price. My question on this is, how reliable is this calculation? I'm asking that question because I cannot believe that if your cost, or in other words, in order to recoup your cost, I cannot understand why Mercer would not approve the selling price, or your tariff rather. So, therefore, I am just a bit concerned about that. So maybe we can have a comment on that. In other words, is that, were those audited? Your depreciation and, you know, the depreciation of the assets and obviously the inflation, you can't, you know, that has to be an accurate figure, but your depreciation. So just a question on that. Slide number 14 deals with the, similar to Dalsmere, sorry, apologies. Slide number 16. You see, I have a problem from the accountant here. Now, the presentation indicates that there is the pressure put on Eskom's finance.
May I request that we close ourselves?
I was trying to.
Chair, can you protect me? We've got a. This is an analysis on Eskom, not on other issues.
Yeah,
so.
You are so protected.
Thank you. pressure on Eskom's finances, now we understand. Normally that would be the case, that your finances or money you borrowed, the capital is in line in a project that is incomplete. But we know that 60 billion rand was borrowed and was not one cent was paid back. So I cannot understand why that statement is true, that that there was pressure because they borrowed money and not 1 cent was paid back, and eventually it was converted into equity. So just a comment on that. I know it's a presentation by the PBO, so they're not to blame for that. Slide number 31 here. I'm just trying to rush just to get one more in so that my time is not... okay, just quickly, I'm not answering one of those short institutions question yet, but I want to know why. Because renewable energy consists of a number of different types of renewable energy, not only solar. Why are we focusing only on solar? There's hydro, there's wood, and so forth. And then my last honourable chairperson, my third one is, the statement was made that the tariffs, and it's included in the formula, the cost is used to determine your tariff. Now, included in that calculation is your depreciation and amongst other things. Now, my understanding is that if you want to calculate a selling price, then you use the cost for now, your current cost, not depreciation, because depreciation you use in order to replace assets. If you need money to invest, in capital, then surely there's two ways of doing that. One is to borrow, which was indicated in the beginning, and the other one is to sell shares. So why are we resorting to the calculation of tariffs by using depreciation in the calculation? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Next.
Thanks, Jay. Thank you for the presentation. But I would also like just to raise a concern, Jay, that next time we will have to look at the length of our presentation, because now we get an hour to ask questions and it sort of disadvantages us that the person that comes and presents for 2 hours, and then we get an hour to ask questions. It's not only particular to the budget office, but to every presentation. It seems it's becoming a norm now that we have to rush to our questions. My one is just, first of all, on the demand currently on Eskom after the load shedding. In that space of time and where we are to date, how many businesses have closed? And what is the demand currently? Because we talked about, yes, we have stabilized the energy supply or the demand on energy, but if we're not going to calculate that in comparison, then how many businesses have closed from then to now, and how many businesses was then on the grid, then, it doesn't make perfectly sum for me, then we haven't actually stabilized it. So if we can just get that one. And then for me as well on the renewable energy one, yes, we speak about renewable energy, but then yet we want to build a nuclear plant that is going to cost the country close to R1 trillion, then we're only going to get electricity with 20 years from now, and we want to let Eskom build that particular plant. And then Eskom, as it stands now, is not even stable on its finances and possible skills to build that plant. So Eskom will have to yet again get people from outside to build that particular plant. And then while we're on skills as well, in terms of skills analysis on pre-1994 and now, in terms of, because one tends to find out that mostly, how can I say this, in terms of, this is the correct, let me use this one. In terms of skills in Eskom currently, how many of that are sourced from outside? Then the one, and how many have Eskom to date developed in terms of South Africa to not outsource in terms of skills? if you have done any work pertaining particular to that. And then just the last one, Chair, as well, in terms, and it's a broader overview to all of the SOEs, that for me and for my party position, we would like to still be a state entity. But we need to look in terms of, you know, when we're hiring or appointing these boards and do these deployments of these boards and stuff like that to this state entity, that there's a particular amount of skills and particular amount of expenditure discipline. Because most of the time that when we see some of these entities' financial burdens and stuff like that, and they collapse, is because majority of the times that there are some board members or some political interference in this board. So if we're not also going to do that correctly in appointing these boards to these state entities, we'll forever have state entities that will live on loans, grants from government, and it will never be at that purpose that we have a state entity that can give over and not be so dependent on the state. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you very much. I heard you talk about expenditure discipline, which also the other way would be fiscal discipline. Okay, thank you so much. The next is Dr. Madope.
Yes, thanks, Honorable Chair. Chair, my question is based on the money that has been given to Eskom. I know that they were in a difficult position, but I don't know whether, but I know that maybe the study did not go deeper to check whether the money that the government has given as a grant, have we get value for money on it? Was it spent on what was on the predetermined objective? That's the thing that you'd want to know as this committee, to say that even if we give, but we know that it was spent on something that values for that particular money. Secondly, Chair, there is a scaring a report that you have indicated. You talk to the possibility that there can be an unplanned negative development that may cause Eskom to divert borrowings to fund operational costs. It's something that, you know, is scary. We would want to check what do you think it can be done, especially for us as the people that are playing oversight and the boards that are playing oversight, to say what is it that we must concentrate on so that we prevent this thing to happen, to borrow for operational usage. Lastly, Chair, I think Comrade Ntlangwini, Honorable Ntlangwini has covered some of the things that I wanted to say. But I want to check, you indicated on the challenge of the aging infrastructure that is the historical to date, and that even when they were trying to do the maintenance, also some of it caused the load shedding. What do you think is the status now? Can we go back to this load shedding because of this aging infrastructure during the time of repairs going forward? And lastly, on the skills, I think Honorable Langwin touched on it, but on different way. I want to check Eskom, do they have the skills, skills that is in line with their mandate, And also in those particular skills, is it domestic skills or internationally hired outside, because we have to develop capacity within our SOEs. Not always, you know, outsource. And my position, where I come from, I'm not in favoring of this thing of outsourcing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member Manana.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Indeed, I would like to concur with you that this presentation was very informative. And I don't want to repeat questions that have been asked already. The issue of the skills that my neighbor have raised, I won't touch on it again. But I would like to talk about this overcapacity which led to the mouth breathing. If you can clarify it more, because we want to, the overcapacity.
Overcapacity. And the critique on the overcapacity.
And in one of your documents, you are talking about their moral hazard.
Yes.
Can you just elaborate on that? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm surprised that you keep forgetting me. Please don't, Chairperson.
But you must also know I missed you so much. Where have you been?
No, that's
fine.
We will definitely have a welcome party. Thank you, Chairperson, and I'm grateful and happy to be back with this committee.
Thank you so much.
Chairperson, when I came in, an input was being given, and the input has been quite valuable, I must say. There are actually about two or three points which I would like to bring forth. The first point, Chairperson, is what I heard over the infrastructure, and I think my colleagues have actually addressed that question. We just need to find out, Chairperson, whether it's genuinely infrastructure that is aging, or it's actually the flip side of the coin, because it could be infrastructure that is aging. It could also be sabotaging the whole system in order to ensure that it does not work. But we need to find out about that. That also goes on to that male Afrikaans mining guys who have a lot of those issues. How much of that has been addressed now to ensure that we actually have a change? Or are we still seeing the same thing, which will still be happening 10, 15, 20 years from now, where in the end it's going to tumble back and fall into place? We need a very clear indication on that. My second point is on what was presented, which actually scared the daylight out of me, Chairperson, and I don't like to be scared during the day. That is when Madame actually spoke of how long will Eskom feed the beast. I think I would like to send the question back to you, Madame. How long will we keep on feeding the beast, because it's us who keep bailing out Eskom. So it's us who keep doing that. So we are feeding this massive beast. How long is it going to take? What are the real reasons behind all of this? Why does one get a feeling? It's just a feeling which I'm getting, that we are getting an input, but it's actually topical. There's something much more than what we are getting here. And I think that is where we need to go, Chairperson. Lastly, the significant increase in finances from the 5 billion in 2016 to 9.3, which is actually half. My colleagues have asked them, where is the value for money? And of course, Chairperson, lastly, just as a by-the-by, I don't need an answer on this one. We may not get a full answer, Chairperson, on how the monies were used, the monies which we used or the monies which we gave as government to ESCOM today. We may not get a full answer because it's a massive report. I think, Chairperson, even if we do get a bit about it today, we need as a committee to sit down at some other time and actually be given an input on exactly how that money was used. Thanks, Chairperson. So that we can justify value for money as has been stated. Thanks, Chair.
Well, thank you so much for all the questions that have been raised. I will now hand over to Professor Shahid to provide responses.
I'm going to ask the team to also respond first in terms of the technical issues. But I must say there were some excellent questions raised around the more underlying issues with respect to ESCOM. And I think the political economy has around COVID, issues that we need to address, the issues of skills, the issues of value for money, the issues of should we feed this beast, the issue of capacity, I think are all critical issues that need to be raised. And my suggestion would be, Chair, from this presentation, is that at some stage we do call in ESCOM into this committee. And we raise these questions purposefully. Because I think these are the subtle issues that, you know, an organization will be able to tackle. And I think, but what's important, Chair, is the back underlying political and economic issues that you raised here, the context, that should not be forgotten. While we can give you the economics and the finance, but I think that context is critical that needs to be raised. And we need to do this, I guess, in a very pertinent way as well, as we take this process forward. But let me just want to give my team, and then we can come back to those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll start, and I'll ask Rashad to come in on the pricing and tariff issues, and I'll ask Gloria to come in on the issues of the jet level. But just to start off, to say that, to just kind of repeating what my director just said, is that what we try to lay out is to say that these are long and deep problems, and that, you know, so when you think about, for instance, where did that equity injection go to, it went into basically the ongoing need for money given the lack of cost-reflective tariffs and the increasing costs linked to new builds, linked to using more diesel, linked to increasing climate energy costs like the cost of coal, and then add to that the cost of labor. So these things have all added up and basically added to the cost of ESCOM, and ESCOM hasn't been able to get as much of revenue because of the tariff increases weren't in line with what they were saying they needed. And so I think part of I think what we need to think about, and Rashad is going to come in on tariff, is linked to that. And I think just also then to talk about the possibility of sabotage. Now I think even if that were to be happening, just given the age of the plant, and this is what we're seeing globally, as electricity plants get to over 30 years old, you know, it's like your car. You know, you've used that car for so many kilometers, you can start replacing parts, you can do things, you're not going to get the same mileage, you're not going to get the same fuel consumption, you're going to be using more petrol, you're going to be using a lot more oil and other things, you're going to spend more labor on keeping it up to speed. And so that's all adding to ESCOM's cost. Plus, we've got the coal mines, where just to get the same amount of coal is costing us more money, and it's lower grade coal. So that adds to the cost. So I think, you know, we need to actually have a sense of what our assets are, right? So we are building new assets, and new assets are going to come on stream hopefully this time on time, and they will to some extent ease that problem and also ease the possibility that there would be load shedding. Now, to go back to the beginning of the question, the Honourable Shofi Sesoli asked, what is renewable energy? The bottom line there is energy that's produced using sources where you're not using up your resources. So it's not digging coal out of the ground and burning it up and that's not used. It's using a resource like the sun where it doesn't matter how much you use, you're always going to have more wind. And with solar, you can have solar water heating, but you also have solar photovoltaic panels. You have wind turbines, wind generation. Countries have moved towards generating coal from electricity from waves. Some places on a smaller scale are using biofuels, waste from animals, and getting gas from that. So there's a large range.
Nuclear
is not non-renewable because you're digging uranium out of the ground, and you're not. You're basically depleting your resources. But also with nuclear, there's also the cost related to how you manage the waste, and the fact that you actually have to manage that waste forever in a sense. You think about our time frame as units, right? I also didn't talk about hydroelectricity as renewable. That's actually the biggest globally, using dams and water. And South Africa has very small hydro capacity, but we source from Kaora Basa. There's a big possibility the Inga Dam north of us could also start be a source of supply to us. But we also use what's called pumped storage systems, where when we've got extra electricity, we'll pump water up a mountain or a hill, and then as we need electricity, we let it flow down and generate electricity from that. So there's those sources. So I think that was something important to understand and explain. I think I'm going to let Rashad go into the tariff issues, because I think it's important to understand how we structuring our tariffs for ESCOM and this whole multi-year pricing determination process.
Thank you. So before I talk about the pricing formula, there's a few other questions. One was under McLaughlin talking about Majupi's units. One of them already online, so we have seen some progress in that respect. Obviously, we all know they've been delayed for quite a few years. But as Fidio presented, I think 6 months ago, it's normal for major infrastructure projects to actually have delays. We've got some data on that. There's a question regarding demand. What we've seen is, for two reasons. One is primarily because of the slowdown in economic growth, but also to an extent, a change in technology and production technology. The electricity demand since 2007 has actually declined. So part of the reason we have not had load shedding since 2008 is not necessarily just because of ESCOM's improved efficiency and grid stability, but also because the economy has been growing slower, mines are demanding less electricity, manufacturing firms are demanding less electricity, which is actually a bit of a concern going forward. So as PBO previously presented, a lot of the demand assumptions from the energy department are actually out of date right now. The trajectory at which we're going to demand electricity going forward is a lot slower. So one of the risks concerned or company major procurements such as nuclear energy is you end up with too much of capacity. So consumers then have to pay for technology which isn't being used, and that's a really big concern then for the economy, for inflation, and for the health of the business environment. That summarizes, I think, load shedding. Also to note, as Siraj pointed out, the older your asset is, the higher your maintenance costs. So what we've seen is ESCOM prior to 2008-2010 has had incredibly well-performing plants. So if you look at the energy availability factor, which says like out of the total year, what percentage of your plants are actually available for production? And we compete with the Europeans, we compete with the Americans. Our plants are pretty well maintained. Post 2010, because we've been running our plants longer and harder, we've had more load shed. We've had to take our plants offline more often, because of some of the issues. So if you drive your car nonstop from here to Mozambique or Kenya or whatever it may be, you're going to have a few blowouts because your car isn't being maintained consistently. Whereas if you drink short runs between here and Musenberg or whatever it is, you're going to have less blowouts. So consequently, we've had more unplanned maintenance because running our plants quite hard. Regarding the energy pricing formula, and this is some work I've done, I've presented a paper on this, so I tend to understand this and its necessity. Compared to other revenue and other formulas or other processes which we could have used, South Africa is using what's quite standard in many utilities. This is the energy pricing policy formula that Eskom currently uses. It's important to note that Eskom applies for revenue. So Eskom says, in a given financial year or 3 years or 5 years of the current multi-year price determination horizon, do we anticipate our primary energy cost to be? How much are we paying our employees for the next year or for the next 3 years? And what is our expected depreciation? So all of these costs are then forwarded to NERSA, plus the value of their asset base, multiplied by an appropriate return on that asset base. So Eskom applies for revenue. Now, NERSA looks at the revenue application and says, actually, no, we think your assumption for coal is a bit too high. We're going to give you $60 per metric ton or whatever it may be, and we think your revenue application for human resources is too high. We're going to cut you down a bit over there, or we think you're too conservative. And so NERSA engages in an iterative process with Eskom. The reason you have an independent regulatory authority is because you've got a national monopoly and the price can't then be set by the monopolist themselves. It needs to approximate what would have been the price in a competitive environment. There were questions raised about the auditing of the value of the asset base. The asset base evaluation takes place every couple of years. It's generally done by one of the big four accounting firms, and this is quite transparent. The big concern over here is what are prudently incurred costs. So has Eskom overpaid its executives? Has Eskom paid too much for coal? Now, this is a function of the strength of the regulator. So NERSA is a pretty decent and a strong outfit. However, we have seen over the past couple of years some senior departures from NERSA, which is a concern about the ability of the regulator to actually preside over the termination process. What I do know is that NERSA does its best, but NERSA does not know everything. I mean, and this is always a moral hazard between the entity as well as NERSA. However, what we must point out is in the MYPD3 from 2012-13 and the five-year horizon, NERSA took decisions which many in industry as well as in other parts of government were very concerned about. NERSA gave Eskom an increase of 6% per year over the five-year horizon, when industry was thinking 8% would have been reasonable, and Eskom was requesting 13%. The concern over here, and a point my colleague Gloria made earlier on, is that by NERSA making that decision, which didn't seem logical or prudent, it actually transferred the risk from Eskom to the fiscus. Now, all of a sudden, government had to step in because Eskom did not receive an adequate return on its asset base. Now, you took a decision that affected the entire economy, forced National Treasury to extend guarantees to Eskom, and in so doing, NERSA increased the risk on government. The opposite or the other option would have been, or the consideration of NERSA at that point in time was that very significant and high increases in tariffs over a five-year period would have been bad for the economy, and there's no doubt about that. So NERSA finds itself in a tricky situation. But the concern over here is when an entity in an election year gives increases that are not sustainable, ostensibly because of the pressure from the electorate. So having said that, I do think we need to look carefully at the role of the regulator in this respect. There's a question regarding depreciation, and should depreciation actually be a cost that's incurred. Based on the literature I've seen and the paper I presented on this, this is quite consistent with what's done in other parts of the world. The reason you have depreciation over there is the depreciation allowance is supposed to provide for replacing the current assets in the over the medium to long-term horizon. So there's nothing inconsistent about that. The other concern I've noted is that Eskom has never received a full return on its asset base. That is a serious concern going forward. I've got that response to most of the questions regarding the revenue formula. Are there any before I hand over to
Can we allow Ms. Ntlangwini?
Yeah, sorry, I just want to check something. But NERSA, the regulator, reports the Department of Energy to the Minister of the of Energy, isn't
Yes,
it?
That's right. But this is an independent body, isn't it?
Yeah, but still the mandate is from...
It falls under there are two pieces of regulation governing NERSA. One is the Energy Pricing Policy of 2008, and one is the Energy Regulator. I forget the full name of the policy from 2006. So yes, it does. Excuse me.
The other one.
The Energy Pricing Policy of 2008. Yeah. That's the EPP. So you're right that NERSA does report to the Department of Energy, but it is an independent body. The reason you have it is because you can't have Department of Energy setting the prices or Treasury or mineral resources or anything of the sort. So yeah, you're right in that respect. Was there a follow-up question from that?
No,
it's fine. If there aren't any questions regarding pricing, I'm going to hand over to Gloria to discuss what accountants do.
Yeah.
Well, mind you, Gloria isn't an accountant, she's a chartered accountant. So I always suspect
Thank you. I'll just attempt to answer two of the questions asked by the honourable member. The first one was why such a significant increase in the cost of debt for just the 6 months in going into 2017. There may be a number of issues there that we will not find answers to now, because unfortunately the interim financial report does not give detailed information on the figures presented. You do get a note, but it's not as detailed as the final financial statement. Potential issues could be the increase in the debt levels, as it is also reflected in the financial, so there is that correlation between the interest increase and the debt level. But also, the accounting framework that they use, the ISIS, requires ESCOM to reduce the total cost of debt with that which is directly aligned to construction of property, plant and equipment. Now with delays in Kusile and Dubi, that amount was reduced from the interest, so it could be there as well. But like I said, we'll have to wait for the final financial statements to be certain about why there's been an increase. And it could as well increase, because this is just at an interim stage. And then on how long we feed the beast, I think that's more of a policy issue. And I think we can all agree that the financial health of ESCOM is of national importance. And it being an SOE, it's not fair to compare it to any other privately owned entity. And you can't just pull the plug. So I think what's important is to work with management and all other affected stakeholders to see how we can improve on efficiencies and make it work. Thank you. Siraj will add on to that substantively.
Okay.
Two more questions to answer.
Okay.
And also, I'll deal with that. And a comment from Dr. Yankis as well. Sorry, before we end it. Sorry to take so long, but there were a huge number of questions, just a quick response to the question from Honorable Shopee Sekole about the materials we use, the references. I'm not sure if members have access to Ubumba, but I'm sure that the system, so what we do is we put all the references and the data that we use onto the Ubumba system. And I'm sure that the researchers and people working with the committee will be able to access that for you. And there are a huge number of this that you'll see. So all of that, and I'll actually go back this afternoon and make sure I've uploaded everything so that you can immediately have access to all the materials that form the background for this document. So that's the quick answer to that. I'm not going to repeat what Gloria said about the importance of the state entity. And here, I just want to, even if it was said in jest, I just want to respond to Honorable Pick that I've got no ties to ESCOM. And I've been putting this as a, so I just take it in jest as it was meant. But that we have to think about it as our asset, you know, as a country, but also as the legislature of oversight, and then think through how do we want to see that asset developing over time, given all the underlying problems, but also the risks and the opportunities in the future linked to that. And there, I think, as we were saying, it's not just a matter of pulling the plug, but it's about developing a plan that's very much related to the overall development and progress of the South African economy. And I think we need to see it as an integrated thing, linked to how we restructure the South African economy, but how we keep it going and growing as well. So I think it's really important from that perspective. Sorry, there was one more. There were so many. I'm losing track. I think, yeah, no, maybe I'm just delaying it. I'm going to let Zosani come in with his comments.
Thank you, Chair. So, two comments from my side. I don't know if I'm loud enough, but I just put this
Okay, thank you. So just want to expand on the point. I think there was a study that we did 2 years back on state-owned entities. I think what we tried to do there, we said there's a competing interest, commercial mandate and developmental mandate. So I think some of the concerns on ESCOM needs to be resolved looking into that framework to say, there's a developmental mandate, there's a commercial mandate. How do you balance the two? That is why I think the question on NERSA, where does it balance, how does it give lower price, this issue of developmental mandate that you know, it's been talked to about a lot. So I think when you look at ESCOM, don't look at it in isolation, look at it broadly. I think with other SOEs, as Sidani said, other SOEs, so to say, what is the purpose of this? Is it commercial mandate or is it developmental mandate? And I think that also brings the point of how far you can feed them. We have to feed the base. Because, again, if you have developmental mandate as a main priority, it means you're going to have to feed that beast to an extent. So I think that's how I wanted to emphasize that commercial versus developmental mandate needs to come up. I think one other thing what we were talking with Silas yesterday, Chair, was that there's probably going to be a point whereby, as Parliament, you appreciate how much debt levels that SOE or government is taking up on these issues and appreciating it and going forward. So how are you going to deal with it? You know, accept it, that's what in a very nice way. What debt are you going to accept and how much are you going to deal with it? And what are the implications quite broadly discuss on a long term? Because I think the idea is that if you don't know the debt levels and what exactly it is, it's kind of a problem because you keep on, you know, guessing it. And so I think we need to appreciate what debt levels has SOE or government as whole has and what is the implication and what the way forward and so on. I think also touching on the issue of renewables, how can it especially such levels of debt. And also coming on the point of cut off our losses, one of the international experience which was mentioned recently was that the renewables are a way of, you know, sort of a way where the energy is trying to shift globally, but also that does not necessarily mean the coal it will be substituted completely, because it's a level whereby you have a mix. Okay, to say you still have to have level of coal, but sometimes one of the experiences has noted that you have a point whereby you need to fall back to the coal to substitute the renewables. So there's need to balance it out. So it doesn't necessarily mean you can cut off and say we're gonna move to the other one. And the point of the skills, I think I was just reading it as an article now with an interview with former President Tom Mbeki, and they asked him what is his regrets of his presidency. And I think he said it quite clearly that one of the regrets for his presidency is not doing enough about the skills development. So he's putting it back to say there's a really great need for skills development in many of these areas. And I think it speaks a lot to to what government is going to do going forward to develop the community windows. Thank you.
Sorry, but before you go,
Yes, it's also, we'll send it before we have, I think we'll send it, but we can send it again. It's so easy on them and so on. But thank
send it to the secretariat, we will then circulate to all the members.
Sure, thank you.
All right, are we done?
Can I just make a last comment? Sorry, just on the issue of steel, I mean, the one thing that we see in the nature of the utility business is because you have periods when there's a lot of building, and then, you know, you have, the pattern seems to be globally, you get overcapacity, then they use up that capacity, and then often they invest too late, and there's shortages, but then you have overcapacity again. And in the development phase, and if you look at South Africa in the 80s and 90s, you know, we actually had much more capacity, and then from the 90s, 2000s, including in nuclear, we started seeing reducing capacities. And by the time we were planning to build the Madupi and Kusile, and this was part of the discussions within the Oaz-Giza process, we realized that South Africa didn't have the capacity to build the boilers, and we needed to import the turbines, but we had lost the ability to maintain and to build new boilers for the power generation plant. And that's just because of how things change over time in the economy and the skills. And people get either retired or they move to other sectors as you get a downturn in building new plants. So that is something that you need ongoing management to do. At the moment, I mean, ESCOM does talk about skills and a skill plan, and they've got an academy. But it may be actually something that the committee directly asked them rather than us, because that's not something we've done deep research on. The last thing was the question of model hazard, which I brought up, and that's an economics term that basically looks at the possibility that someone who doesn't have to bear the full cost of something will act in a way, even if it's not out of malevolence or bad intention. But their incentive structure is to actually spend more money or to take more risk or to build more capacity, because that's the incentive. And they know that ultimately the consumer or the government will pay. And so what I was pointing out is that in the oversight process, that we need to be really conscious of that and reduce the space. The fact that we've got NERSA does actually help in that, but I think there are lots of other things, especially going forward in managing the debt and thinking through how ESCOM gets supported by government, future guarantees, possibly future equity injections, to be really specific and think through how that support is given, and making sure that it doesn't go into overcapacity or inefficiency. Sorry for taking so long. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yo, I must apologize, ne, for the venue that does not have an aircon. I promise you, everybody is. It is so hot. As long as you don't sleep, let's tolerate the heat, but please don't sleep. I need all of you. Okay, bye for your participation. But then, let me quickly check on the follow-up questions. And then, yeah. I know other people are now have to attend other meetings, but it's fine. You still have to remember we have an agenda to finish also. All right, no, that's fine. So how many follow-up questions do we have? One.
No.
I know we spoke about fiscal discipline, and then what other discipline? Okay, no, that's fine. Honourable member. Shoppers Toilet, and then Honourable Member Dr. Fick, and then I'll also ask.
Thank you very much, Dr. I just want to suggest that, you know, we have been empowered a little bit, you know, eye-opening by this. I'm suggesting that we have a two-day workshop where we call ESCOM and NERSA and PPO, so that we sit away from this and we deal with this. ESCOM and other SOEs is where a lot of money is spent or wasted. So if you want to be healthy, don't put words into my mouth. Please, I'm the study, but remember that. Eskom and other SOEs, most of the money department transferred it. And if we're serious about following the money as this committee, we need to understand exactly so that when we actually make decisions, it's not based on our preconceived ideas or emotions. We are factual. That is the only way out. The other thing is, you don't have to regret for the heat that we are feeling, me and my friends, because it actually confirmed one thing. He was telling me that the aircon is not working because the ANC is ruling. When the DA rules, there will be...
Can I rule you out then, of order on that one? And
no,
focus, so that you focus on the Western table instead of other things.
He forgot that this is the Western case.
All right, next.
Yes, thank you. This evaluation that was done by the World Bank on these groups, can I just do we know? My question is, of these 40, are they all 100% wholly owned by the state? And then those that are profitable, the 10, yeah, okay, do we know which ones are wholly owned? And do we know where there are some that are privately owned?
All right, I have a comment next. I just want to find out, from your own look of things, was it a wise idea to then transfer facilitation of the project on the nuclear energy to Eskom? Because it needs to have capacity so it can take off the ground, and you know, so the main objective of this project is achieved. Was it a wise decision, or can you maybe make us understand on what informed that decision, and was it a wise decision? Okay. I know we've complained about aging power stations and how this has been a burden on Eskom, but let me tell you something. The best is to maintain, because shutting down would be the worst. So, regardless of the fact that it is a problem, but we still, they have to be maintained so that we can continue to have this light instead of darkness during the day. Okay, and then the other one is, all right, no, I just wanted to comment on this. Oh yes, you spoke about serious coal shortages in future. I have a problem with that one. So for instance, I know that in Mpumalanga, almost the underground is made of coal. And as a result, when I was MEC for Economic, Environment and Tourism, mine was to stop people from, because then there would be no place, you know, for residences, your protected areas, and because everybody wanted to. Why now this threat of shortages of coal in, because I know that Eskom also depends on the coal. Okay, coal supply, yes, all right.
I'll try quickly, and if my colleagues want to come in. The question on the World Bank study, what they did was across the world, where you have different models of utilities, and also you have different arrangements in terms of having transmission and distribution not in a vertical utility like Eskom, and different parts of it are publicly owned and different parts are privately owned. So it's a huge mix. So it's not, I don't think it's easy to say, well, the 10 that were not profitable were all state-run because they don't have the market pressure on them and they can be bailed out and the others weren't. Because what happens is when you have, even when you have a privately owned generation or distribution and they start running into problems, the state actually, to maintain energy security, will step in and support them. And that's what's happened in India, where a lot of the distributors are actually privately owned and they're running into trouble, and the state's actually giving them borrowing bonds and lending to them at below market rates so that they can pay the generators for the electricity they bought from them. So it's not a simple, straightforward answer to that question. There's a huge mix, and both private and publicly owned utilities are in trouble. In relation to the aging power stations, I think we're not actually suggesting that they be closed down. We're suggesting that we take as much advantage of our existing assets as possible. So but within that, as my colleague Rosani said, I keep mixing up those words. My colleague Rosani said it's about the mix. And in the near future, we're not going to suddenly close down coal and put in renewables. It's going to be a process, and that's a process happening all over the world. And so I said there's been a process in Europe and the US where new generation in 2016 was predominantly in renewables, but that's only 1 year of building of stock. The rest of the stock is all coal and thermal production. And then on the possibility of coal shortage, I think the issue there is are we going to get enough coal mines developed, enough money invested in new coal mines in time to meet the demand? We're still using the power stations that had been built where the coal mines that are now depleted are, and we're going to have to either expand rail capacity or use the roads. And our roads are being eaten up by all the coal stuff going up and down. So there can be additional costs there. So the question is, you know, we've got the coal, we've got lots of coal, are we going to get enough mining? And that's a similar question that, for instance, in India, the way they talk about doubling coal capacity. In South Africa, I think we're looking at similar scales of new coal mining coming online. And whether it will be in time by, say, the early 2020s to meet increasing demand. So that's my director.
We're done. Okay. Honorable members, hey, this was a very interesting one. Just to say to Mr. McLaughlin, now I understand why also Brian Dames resigned. He started there when I discovered there was a problem with the old power station. And at a particular time, we were not even meeting NEMA, your National Environmental Management Act, and we were expected to close down for health because they were now a health hazard. Besides that, they cannot produce and they must be maintained. Also, they knew they were a health hazard. So, and then there was a directive to shut them down, Grill and Duva, and I was the MEC there, and then we had to take a decision that we shut down this is. So I had to authorize that, but we couldn't. That's why I realized that, hey, this thing is big. Yeah, but no, that's fine. Thank you so much for the information. Indeed, it has enriched our knowledge. And you can hear members even want more now. And actually, this presentation alone has made me to realize the importance of getting the presentation on the finances of all the SOEs. But honourable member, surely remember, the committee has already decided that we will be calling those that we prioritize. How many? SOEs that have been prioritized? 6, 8. That we have prioritized? Okay. But because of time constraint, we said we are going to call them together with the departments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But by the time we go there, at least we should have the information. Maybe we should communicate with you on time so that when we go to those meetings, we should have these reports on the SOE's finances. So that our engagement becomes very meaningful and helpful and useful, and also that we can make the impact. Okay. But thank you so much. You can see that this one, today, you've helped us big time. So I will then, because we've got other business to do, I will then I can release you so that the committee can proceed with its further business. Thank you so much. We really appreciate. Yeah, we really appreciate you. All right, honourable members, shall we then proceed because we have time constraint? There are two sets of minutes that need to be adopted by this committee. It is the minutes of the 1st of March, 28th of February. Are we proceeding, honourable member Shoppers Tolle?
Yes, sure.
Of the meeting?
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you, sir. Thank you, really appreciate. All right? These minutes were circulated on time, and the assumption is that members have given themselves time to peruse through the minutes. So we will now entertain corrections on the minutes. Corrections on page 1. Page 2 of the set of minutes of the 28th of February. Page 2. Corrections on page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Okay, any adoption of the minutes is a true reflection of what transpired in the previous meeting? Any proposal for adoption? Honourable Member Pease, Dr. Pease, are you proposing? I saw your hand going up.
Yes, anything, just I propose adoption of the minutes.
Come again?
I said I propose adoption of the minutes.
Okay. Any seconder?
I can't support.
Honourable Member Adan, seconded by Honourable Member Dr. Mato. Thank you very much. All right, we now say on the set of minutes of the 1st of March. These two were circulated on time. The assumption is that you've read the minutes. So we'll now look at corrections. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3, page 4, I know that my input to Darren was, maybe instead of us saying summary of decisions, because we don't take decisions. We make recommendations. Maybe this one, because I did say, I sent that message to say, can we replace this with resolution? We resolve. Say, summary of resolutions by the committee, or the committee resolved as follows, and then all right. If there are no other corrections, may we get a proposal for adoption of the minutes? Mr. McLaughlin?
Why are we not taking a decision?
No, it's not a decision, it's a resolution. We resolve, and then the House, and then we take our recommendations to the House. So if we take a decision, there's no need now to go to the House for approval, for adoption. We don't decide, we resolve, and we make recommendations. Based on the recommendations on our resolution of the meeting. All right, thank you very much. And then there's a new item, program of action. Honourable Member Dr. Peek, could you please lead us?
Yes, thanks, Honourable Chair.
Thank you. I'm not suggesting or proposing that we get into a serious discussion, because I understand that it's not always possible for the program to be fixed for an entire period. But just an appeal from my side is when we do have a program, because if you look at our program, it does get updated on a regular basis. Now, just an appeal. I understand, but I'm just saying, as soon as, because if you look at last week, what happened, it was changed and chopped, but That's just my appeal. And then with regards to last week, we also need to, as a committee, make sure that, and again, I understand and I'm speaking for myself here, that it's not, people have made other arrangements, but last week, Friday's meeting, there was some valuable information and input at that meeting. So, and I'm hoping that the members that were not there are not going to take it personal that I'm picking on them, but that we must try and be present at the meetings because Friday, after all, is a working day, I understand. And then with regards to Tuesday's meeting, again, now that one, again, it was out of our control, but I think we need to speak to the chairpersons as well because it doesn't help us attending a meeting. Okay, I know we made a resolution that we won't input, we won't contribute, but we will call them to our meeting. But that it's not, I mean, a meeting like that, I mean, everybody's interested in your social development as well as water and sanitation. So just that at least if the meeting is managed, if possible, that we at least get some sort of an input. So it's just something that we need to just try and manage. I know it's not difficult, but that's just what I wanted to say to you. Thank you.
Well, as you know, we can only grow from all these innovations and quality inputs as a committee. So we take note of your input, Dr. Afi. Honorable Member Tlamini.
Thanks, Chair. My input also to program and one that is slightly different. I don't know if I'm going to be out of order. But the one on the programming of national treasury, I would propose if we have committees of such nature, yes, the budget office one that they have given us input to was also very much valuable and it's related to our work. But if we can try by all means to get like departments like National Treasury rather on a Wednesday, and it will give us more time to get clarified questions and so forth, because if on a Friday everyone will be like, no, I need to catch my flight, we need, you have limited time to ask questions and stuff like that. So if we can just in terms of programming do that. And then the second thing is I see we are getting now the presentations the night before the meeting for whichever meeting that we are attending. And then sometimes we don't get the researchers' feedback on the presentation. And sometimes what they used to do on that research was very valuable for us to also get an understanding on the presentation. So if we can just get work on that presentations be sent 2 days before time so that we can also get the researchers' brief, because now for 2 weeks we didn't get, well, we got the researchers' brief in the morning or something like that. So if we can work on that as well. Thanks, Jane.
It's just an area of improvement, and so we know that you produce quality work, but you must just up your game. But also, you know what happens. I know that sometimes we praise you too much, and now you're becoming complacent. Please don't fall into that temptation. Shall we proceed in the manner in which we have been working? Eh? Because you can see that I'm missing it. So that's why I must plug into that gap. So please, let's circulate. It helps, you know, 2 days before to allow members to meet. Because 1 day is not good. It's not good enough. But also your research, because it also helps members to go to meet, to attend meetings fully prepared. You can see it in the level of engagement. So which means you have a key role to play towards our successful meetings. So thank you very much. We also take note of that, and we're hoping that there will be some. I know that, but you were talking more then. If I try to control it.
She asked the question, Chair.
No, I'm asking my friend.
She has taken over.
But I can hear from here.
sorry.
Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, and then otherwise, I'm happy. Are we done with the program of action? We really apologize for the changes, but please, if you can allow me to
where necessary, you know, I promise you, I will not just, you know, but I thought I should give leadership where I think this in particular will benefit us. Or you saw yesterday, we now so ready for them, and we must prioritize the two departments. I thought if we go to that joint meeting, there will be no need for us to call them, but unfortunately, our appetite has been sharpened. Now we need them to come so that we can engage with them. So you will see where you fit them. Eh? Thank you very much. And then, closure. Honourable members, I really enjoy meeting with your good selves. And I know sometimes... There's correspondence that we received from PAXA, which is a Peter Maritzburg agency for community social action. Now, they are doing it through the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office, or in partnership with them. Now, they have a workshop where they'll be unpacking the 2017 budget. So what are the options for the poor? So we then have applied through the chairperson's office and the chief whip's office, who have agreed that we can attend because it has relevance to our work. So those that are available, you must know we have permission, we can attend.
It's tomorrow, yes.
Yeah.
It's member coming to me now so that I can tell them.
Confirm. Yeah, those that will be available, not compulsory, but those that are available, submit the name so that Zandi can submit the link to the facilitator.
Yes, you can go.
One of you,
do you know what is this paper all about?
Chair, are you going to meet
for us? I can't go without the opposition.
What is it that you want me to
propose?
There is permission. So it depends on your availability. If you are available to go there, you can go.
I am available.
We have permission. I'm trying to say you can absent yourself from the activities here to go and attend. We needed that permission.
Okay, well,
so all the names, please should be forwarded. There's a caucus.
We are having it
in the morning, and then after that, what time is it finishing? 12:30. Yeah.
10:30 to 12:30.
Yeah, it's not going to take long.
Then there's lunch afterwards.
We're there.
Yeah.
Okay. Past 9.
Yes.
Where is the place? The
Townhouse Hotel.
Cross the road.
Oh, that's one. That is the
hotel. Please circulate this because members do not seem to have received this.
We do have it.
No, we mean the area, not the hotel. Okay. No, that's fine. So at least you can see, we really want members to be very, very empowered. You know, and we can see we're enjoying and we are benefiting, and it helps us big time. Yeah? Okay, thank you very much. I was saying I really enjoy meetings with you, and more importantly, I can see that you really come here prepared, and then and the engagements were very relevant. I think that's what is going to help us to grow. And actually,
the chair was good.
If you check from the time when we started, we now. The gear has been shifted to a higher level.
Yeah.
So keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
Meeting
sets agenda.
Thank you. How can you agenda before I bring the chair?
Not part of the agenda.
I'm going to go to the next one.